You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Why don't you introduce yourself and be like, hi, this is my name and this is what I'm... So Arpita is doing... I just like said I wanted you to introduce yourself. Never mind. That's going to be edited out. Bleep, bleep. This is East Side Story, and I'm your host, Chiang Ng. Each week, I sit down with an Asian or Asian American artist working in the New York theater scene, and I excavate their life story. How they grew up, how they got their start in theater, as well as projects they've worked on and upcoming work that we should anticipate. This week's guest is Arpita Mukherjee. She is the artistic director of Hypocrite Theater Company, the book writer of Monsoon Wedding, a 2018 O'Neill Directing Fellow and Lincoln Center Directing Fellow, and her resume is basically too long to list. I am working with Arpita on my musical, The Golden Threshold, and her relentless insight into dramaturgy is remarkable. I'm extremely thankful to be able to call her my collaborator and friend, and it's a gift to be working alongside her.
Hi, my name's Arpita Mukherjee. And I am the artistic director of Hypocrite Theater Company and the founder. I always keep forgetting that. It's like I was hired or something. But I was the founder and artistic director of Hypocrite Theater Company. I am also a director, and I work on primarily new work, new musicals and new plays. Yeah, that's kind of what I do.
I love that you're like so nervous and you're like fiddly.
I don't like talking about myself specifically.
Why?
But
you're so amazing. Like, you do so much good stuff. And, like, you need to talk about it. People need to know who you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm here. I'm not scared at all. Let's dig deeper.
Talk a little bit about your childhood. So, before that, like, how long have you been living in the city?
You know, someone asked me that a couple of days ago. And I was like, oh, my God, I've been living in the city for 8 years.
Wow. And where did you move from?
I moved from D.C., D.C. area, Northern Virginia, to be specific, for those Nova folks out there. Yeah.
And so 8 years, and how do you find the city? Do you like it?
Yeah, the city is my home. I mean, I'm a New Yorker, for the good and the bad. Like, I say that as, like, kind of a matter of pride, but also just, like, I think the city encompasses both whatever strengths I have, but also my flaws. So I say that not as like a badge of honor, but just like a reality that this is my city. It's where I feel most at home. I feel really neurotic and out of place in most other places. With the exception probably being Bombay is probably the other place I feel. Mumbai, closer.
Doing but, too much Golden Threshold.
Yeah. but yeah, I love it. I love it. I never want
to
leave.
Okay. Let's go like all the way back to like early Arpita times and like
early times.
Where did you grow up and how big was your family? What was that experience like?
I was born and I grew up in New Delhi. And I mean, I lived in a nuclear family. My parents were living in New Delhi, but we're part of a much bigger extended family, which was sort of all over the country. I mean, I'm Bengali. I'm from the eastern part of India. But my family was partly in Calcutta, partly in at that time in Patna. We used to get together for holidays, but I was to say I was definitely New Delhi kid. and grew up really like Anglophile upbringing, like reading Charles Dickens, Enid Blyton. But it was a very performing arts loving family and arts loving family where we went to concerts, listened to Indian classical music. And I studied singing with my grandma, Tagore music, Bengali music. And like my dad was really into films and music and theater. And so it was just I was from a very young age, very exposed to the arts. In Delhi, the culture was not as arts oriented as my family who was from Calcutta. So every time we'd go visit, the kids never had time because they would go from school to like drawing, like art class and then like music class and then dance class. And they're like, what do you do? And I was like, watch TV. but it was my family was very... very artistically inclined, and that was made up a big part of how we interacted and hung out with each other. So I think that's something, even though nobody did it as a profession, it was really something that defined how I identified as a human being, was the arts were a big part of my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have siblings?
I have one sister. Mm-hmm. She's a doctor. Wow. She's the good one. But we also dance. So when I got married, she did an Odissi dance. And so, you know, it's a kind of a stereotype. I remember people telling me, like, Indians do everything. And I was like, well, arts are just like a part of how you interact in your community, you dance, you sing. So I think it's a part of everyone's life. Yeah.
When did you move to the States?
I moved to the States in 96.
Oh, wow. That's a while ago.
96 now.
It's not that long ago. I mean, it was long ago. It was like 23 years ago.
23 years ago.
Wow. Wow. Mental math. Hashtag Asian.
The funniest thing is I was just going to say 13. And then I was like, how old am I? How could I have moved here 13 years ago? This doesn't make sense. Yeah.
So did you go to school here as well? Like did you do part of like your, I don't know what the system is in India. Is it primary, secondary, or is it like elementary, high school? Is it American system?
Primary, secondary.
It's so the British system.
Yeah, it's a British system. I came here that was still elementary school here. Mm-hmm. That would have been towards kind of the end of primary school, you know, mm-hmm. Fourth, fifth grade. And then I had the joy of being able to go to middle school, which nobody, I think, really wants. It's kind of a nightmare, like seventh, eighth grade in like a different school. But I had a really, really hard time adjusting. School was very tough for me. I was just raised, first of all, I think in India, you really develop emotionally very close, almost charged relationships. Your friendships are very, very close. It's very intimate, I would say, you know. So I had there was a group of us and we were just such close friends. And in India also, what was really valued was that you were good at school and you were good in the arts. That meant you were a popular kid.
Wow.
It was like every year the rankings would come out and like the top three students, which I think is terrible and shouldn't be there. But those were the most kind of admired kids. So being good in school was, and I wouldn't say I was that good in school in India, but that was something that was admired.
When you say you weren't that good in school, were you like number two?
I was like usually like two or three, and it was really upsetting. And my best friend, we used to always be number one. And I remember when you do your exams and you get your papers back, and I'd get like 49 out of 50, and she'd have gotten like 49 and a half. So the thing that separated the three, you know, there wasn't
this
much.
This is the most Asian thing you would say. Like, I was not that great in school. I was just number two. Oh my God. So relatable.
Yeah. the thing was, I have to say that I have a very, still a very good memory. And so I was a very, very indisciplined student. I just did not have any discipline and no.
And like, she still got 49 out of 50. Yeah.
So. But I had a really good memory. So I would just be able to remember things really well. But, you were really supposed to excel. You were encouraged to excel, not fit in. I know people may not think that about Asian communities, but the thing that drives us that everyone's like, there's a billion people like you. Right. So you have to stand out.
Right.
And when I moved to the US, it was immediately, I was a, you know, still had an accent, obviously dressed in a certain kind of way. Also, in India, you have uniforms. So clothes mm-hmm. are not, you don't think about what you're going to wear every day. It's not, you know, and it, already at sort of like 10, 11, there's fashion, there's like what brand you're wearing. I mean, it was very, very culture shock in a way that I just knew how to like go to school, hang out with my friends and study. Like
right.
those were the pillars of my life, not that's like...
So Asian, but also so true. I mean, Singapore is also a British colony. So we had, well, was a British colony. So we also had uniforms. We also had like structure and rigor. And of course, everyone expected you to excel in school. But once again, I think, I mean, we're not going to go into that, but like the whole idea of like standardized testing and like, yeah. that is a certain way of doing things. And I think it worked for certain people, but it definitely didn't work for everybody. But I mean, if you succeeded in that, you would find, you know, quote unquote, success, right?
Yeah, yeah.
In the society that we were in.
Yeah.
So I think that's something very similar
yeah,
to Singapore.
Yeah. I think, but here I felt that there was I was very ahead in everything when I came to the US, super ahead in math. I was also a really fast reader because mm-hmm. you just had to read and memorize so much more in India. I just used to read, you know, the homework assignments. I'd get home and like in an hour, I'd be like, done. And my dad was like, you know, so. But you know what happened is I was so ostracized for it and so disliked for being ahead or raising my hand that I forced myself into being more mediocre.
Oh, my God.
So in about a year and a half, I was just like everyone, you know, I didn't push myself because I think I've always been someone that I think that's why I do arts. I need community and people around me to thrive. Mm-hmm. I'm not kind of like, you know, a loner and I'll just do my old thing and just be really great at it, which a lot of kids, I kind of envy those kids because I think I came really ahead in things in especially school, but just had a real intellectual curiosity that I kind of instead was like, oh my God, if I like vacuum, I remember my parents used to have like, okay, if you want to make more pocket money, which was like is not a thing in, you know, because I wanted to go shopping. They were just like, you have to, and there was a dollar we'd get if we vacuumed the whole house. So my sister would just keep vacuuming the house over and over again, just so we could buy like, at that time it was Abercrombie or something. I mean, we had such, like when I look back at it, I was like, wow. Or I could have just read more books during that time, but did not.
You were becoming more and more American.
I was becoming very, like, more and more American. We'd watch all the TV shows so that our accent would go away, you know, and things like that. And I had then also completely lost touch with sort of, like, more the classical arts, Indian arts. The only thing I stayed connected with the whole time was Bollywood. I never lost Bollywood. It was, like, the one thing that I would still watch every Bollywood film. It was
why,
the only
why?
Thing about, I don't know. I've always just been really fascinated. It was always such a dreamscape in a way, or maybe it was Bollywood films were just still helping me escape how lonely I felt here.
Mm.
It's probably what it was. And it was a way to connect with culture that was most accessible. It was also the thing I think people don't realize about India is that Indians are super diverse, you know? And I came from a particular Bengali, really traditional arts, you know, classical arts culture. But most of the kids I was meeting didn't come from that. They mm-hmm. came from more like Bollywood or folk or, you know, kind of. And so what our common language, even for as Indian Americans, was, hey, did you go see this Indian movie with, you know, all the parents and the kids would go to the local Indian movie theater and watch it. And, you know, so it was also our shared experience, despite we all spoke different regional languages. So it was like this one thing that united us.
That's so beautiful because it's like, you know, I know this is also a stereotype of me saying this, but a lot of people view, like, for example, Indian people, and then it's like, oh, you're all the same. You're
yeah.
all Indian.
Yeah.
So, like, you must have
yeah.
so much in common.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of commonality in terms of, like, being Asian, being a certain race, being, you know, but yeah. then there's also so much that differentiates us.
Yeah, like, we make up a lot of the world. So, of course, we're, you know, going to be really varied and different. And I think that, or, you know, when people are like, they assume, like, the people will ask me questions about, you know, Indian cuisine as chicken tikka masala or whatever, you know, that I grew up
eating. That's also, like, not real, isn't it? Like, isn't that invented here?
It's invented in British. In British? Well, I'm tired. Invented in the UK by a British man. That's what I wanted to say. Who wanted to make Indian food more palatable for Brits. Yeah. And now it's eaten everywhere. And the closer thing, the better a dish you want to look for and is a good test for an Indian restaurant is if they have butter chicken. Butter chicken is a North Indian dish that is far more delicious than chicken tikka masala.
You heard it here first.
Please look for that in an Indian restaurant.
And if that doesn't pass the grade, then don't eat there.
Don't go there. Don't go there. Unless it's a buffet. Because then the quantity and the variety will make up. But, like, look at their menu, and if they don't have butter chicken and they only have chicken tikka masala, I may be, like, talking smack about some great Indian restaurants right now. But, yeah.
It's great. And so,
a pro tip.
So you went through middle school, high school here. And did you do a lot of, like, performing arts, like, American performing arts when you were in the high school? No?
No, I didn't do... Well, I took drama in middle school, and my best friend in middle school was Christina Gaddy, who now sings all over the world.
Shout out!
Christina, she does Postmodern Jukebox. She was my best friend in middle school.
That's amazing. And do you still keep in touch?
Yeah, we totally keep in touch. And we used to talk about musical theater a lot, and theater, and she was kind of really a fan of old Hollywood films, you know, and I realized that many Bollywood films were plagiarized from old Hollywood films through hanging out with her. But we used to and that was sort of some connection I had. But I was very much supposed to become a doctor. It was ordained. I was good in science, math. I wasn't bad at it, so there was no reason to really not do that. But I wasn't excited by it. But same. It was only high school, kind of late high school, that I felt that. But I had no idea what to do because there was no one that looked like me doing it.
That is so interesting because this is, like, so real. I mean, there are people who look like you when you're back in your home country, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, everyone in India, it's kind of like a homogenous society where, like, the people you see in the media there are...
Yeah.
You know, Indian people. But, like, in America, that's a completely different situation.
Yeah.
And, I definitely excelled in science and math, and I was, like, supposed to be a lawyer. Didn't do it. Like, that was, like, the first blow to my parents.
Yeah.
And then, like, went into, like, the whole, like, it's crazy. But I'm also, like, is it very stereotypical? Is it, like, because we're Asian, that's why we have to, like, be doctors and be lawyers? Is that, like, I know it's a huge stereotype, but then part of the stereotype is that it's true. Like...
Yeah, I think part of that, I think what's worth investigating in that stereotype is why that may have come to be, you know? And I think part of the reason for that is how we come mostly from colonized nations, you know? We come mostly from nations where they saw that there were certain positions of power, you know? In India, a big thing is becoming an IS officer. It's sort of like a civic government position.
What is it called again?
IS officers. They're sort of it's like you take a civil service exam and you can do it. It's they also kind of like run... I'm probably messing this up. I probably don't know this exactly, but they're also kind of like run the police departments and the sort of like criminal investigation department. And you have to do really well on certain exams to do it. That's a hangover from the British, but is still really in a place where you would say doctor, engineer, that's a really, really important.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
That is so interesting that you like highlight. I didn't even think about this. I'm thinking a lot about what you just said in terms of we come from colonized nations and it's a leftover situation because we're seeking that power, that control.
Yeah.
And that's like the path towards success because that seems like what is successful that was literally left behind by the British.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I think, and you know, financial power, right, is something you want to seek. And so I think that's really where that comes from. It's not just some, like, ordained genetic thing that, like, Asians want to be, you know. That's, I think it's worth investigating. It's an easy stereotype to make when you've been the community that has had the privilege to choose whether you wanted to be a doctor, and you know what I mean? But it's when you look at it, it's because resources were taken from when the imperialists took resources that took away people's ability to dream. So when you rebuild a nation, or, you know, you build a nation, it's not, everything is not available to you. Things have been taken from you. Things have, you know, there was infrastructure built too, but, and also there's no way to imagine any of these colonized nations as not post-colonial, as a not affected culturally by colonization of what is class and what is success and hierarchy.
100%. Right? So. Like, even the conversations nowadays that are revolving around, I mean, gay rights, LGBT rights, and trans people, like, just the conversation of these have always existed in India, and they were taken away because there were Western influences imposed upon it. And then it's like the West tells you this is wrong.
Yeah.
And then you adopt that, you know, that thought process, and you'd be like, oh, yeah, that is wrong. And you have laws that are, you know, residual from the British rule, and they are still in effect in some countries, aka Singapore, and then India just like recently, you know, decriminalized homosexuality, and that's very interesting that a lot of people are like, well, it was never criminalized to begin with, it was because the West came in and criminalized it, that's why there's this whole process, right? So it's like, it is kind of like the process of like decolonizing.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, that's really well put. People talk about this with India and gender, of course, too, you know, rights for women. And it's really interesting because there's, if you trace it back, part of a lot of the decline in existing women's rights happened when colonization happened. Mm. And just the idea of actually even sexuality and sensuality and sort of building laws around that is super British. It's like, you know, the idea of the blouse that goes with the sari. I love telling the story because, like, saris were never supposed to be worn with blouses. The Brits invented the blouse because they got too distracted by the women in saris, you know, without wearing blouse. So there's all these beautiful photos of my grandma just, like, wearing a sari. She's not wearing a blouse, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, and, like, that's where the blouse, you know, to wear it under it comes from. So the idea of even legislating a woman's body is definitely very, very colonial.
Oh my God. I'm just like having like kind of like an epiphany in terms of like how many countries have Britain personally affected, even America, right? Like just like across the world, how many countries who are now sovereign, they have literally affected. But I wouldn't say like it's all for the worst, you know, like that's a whole other conversation
that's a complicated thing.
So complicated.
Well, I think it's mostly for the worst, but as most things that are happen in the world, they have some, but you know, when people say like, oh, but they give us the railroads, I'm like, it kind of assumes that like India would have never built railroads. Like how, you know, a sophisticated, a civilization that was so highly sophisticated could have probably figured out how to build a railroad, you know? So in a way, when people say that of you know, brought education, I'm like, well, it brought a certain type of education. People were still being educated in India. And in some ways didn't help necessarily some of the other things. But anyway, it's a complicated relationship, but I don't think it's like, maybe it would have been worse if they didn't colonize us. I reject that completely.
Right. I mean, it's a totally different... Well, we can't imagine it, first of all. Maybe someone should write something that's like completely that, right? It's like, there's the show, like The Man in the High Castle, if like the Soviets won, and what would the world be like?
Oh, yeah,
maybe someone should, you know, you heard it here first. I renounce my idea. You can go write it, right? Write something like, what if the world was never colonized in the first place? Oh, what would that be?
What a great play.
Oh my God, maybe I should write that.
Write that play. Here we go. Here we go. This is like...
I mean, that's very interesting. I think that's very interesting, especially thinking about how nowadays when we... You know how... Okay, this is something that I grew up thinking because I was educated. Like, there was a lot of Western influence with a lot of, like, Eastern influence in my life. I'm literally a walking, like, dichotomy and, like, just everything is fighting against each other.
A post-colonial figure, perhaps?
Just like so raw, like so many opposing thoughts.
And
I wonder, like, you know how we like see colonies or like people who are just like not in the cities, who like still live in non-technology, like not influenced by technology. And then we were like, oh, why are they doing, like, people sometimes will be like, why are they doing that? Why are they not part of the 21st century? Why are, who's to say that they don't have a good life? Who's to say that they have not found what they wanted in life and in that society, in that community that they built?
And who's to say they are not being inventive?
Yeah.
You know, or that they don't, that their culture and their practices don't have progress. I feel like for, in most of the world, and this actually, I think about this a lot when I think about climate, is that I think it's a fundamental shift of what we think is valuable in our life and what we are making progress towards, you know, and if it's amenity and ease and luxury, which have been really the modes in which West has led the path, and this is progress, you know, having a car is has led the way. It makes me wonder if that's truly progress, or if other cultures have been inventive in other ways, in terms of how they use resources, right? And that is a different kind of progress, but perhaps teaches us something about existing in this world that is useful. So I'd be super interested in that play too, you know, and just how a nation that has never been colonized would think about progress and create its own chart of progress, you know.
I'm like getting very inspired, like so inspired. This is like great. But also it's like so paradoxical, because we are recording in a recording studio using all this modern technology to talk about progress and tradition, and it's just so hard to exist right now. Yeah. It's like, what is right? You can't, they are all in opposition.
And this tension is not resolvable, you know, in the way that I studied post-colonialism a lot, so I think about this a lot. But even the tension of what it means that we tell our stories in English, you know, there's been a huge movement in India toward, especially in theater, to not do theater in the English language. And it's a sort of decolonization of theater. But then what does it mean for people like us who were educated in English, you know? I think that tension is where a lot of drama is. So, and worth mining, but I don't think it's resolvable in any way, because we can't live like that. That's an interesting thought experiment even, but like, we can't exist. And how does a person who is actually post-colonial dream up a world, right? Like, how do we...
Like, no one has lived through that, really.
How do we dream up a world in which that was not how we lived? Or, you know, it's super, super interesting and kind of...
I would love to go down that road.
You're going down it right now, I feel like. I see it. Yeah.
And that's, I think, a perfect segue into, like, theater.
Yeah.
So, like, when did you start doing theater the way that you're doing it right now?
Oh, the way I'm doing it right now, I think probably 10 years ago or so in DC.
Did you go to college in DC?
I went to college at UVA. And I studied English. So it was really not, I really thought I was going to be a fiction writer.
Oh, wow. I mean, you are a writer and you are writing fiction too. Not like books and novels, but.
Yeah. Going back to this, like, who looks like me, the only people I could think of was Arundhati Roy had just written God of Small Things, which is probably the single most impactful story that I have, like, read or experienced in my life.
Can you say that title again?
It's God of Small Things. Great. By Arundhati Roy.
Never read it. I'm going to go read it now.
It's amazing. And she's an amazing writer, and she has also a new second novel that's great, The Ministry of Unhappiness. And Jhumpa Lahiri, who wrote The Interpreter of Maladies, her short story collection, won the Pulitzer.
Wow.
And so they were two writers who were really, had captured the world's imagination. And so I was like, I could do that. And so I really wanted to be a fiction writer. And in one of the courses I was taking at UVA, we had to write a play, and I wrote a play. And I submitted that play to a festival the Smithsonian was doing for South Asian writers, and I submitted it, and that play made it. And then I was in the room with another director, saw the director directing, and, you know, he's a great friend of mine, and but I wanted to do that. I felt like I had a sense of how to craft a performance, like, just instinctively. I didn't know anything about directing, but I felt like I knew how to shape a performance.
Was that like the turning point for you, like college?
It was a turning point. It was a call. It was, I think at that moment I was just wanting to do that, but I definitely had no clue how to do it professionally. Mm. So I started interning, assisting Washington Shakespeare Company, Shakespeare Theater Company, and was, like, particularly very interested in classics. But it was, D.C. was also a classics town. Mm-hmm. So it, you know, at that time, of course. So that was sort of what I did. But very quickly, I decided that there were certain stories I wanted to tell. And so I started a company, and, you know, a lot of the community who had those jobs, you know, who were doing theater as a hobby, well, they had great jobs. They were making a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So they would say, okay, we'll, like, produce this, you know, and fund this. So it was sort of, that's how, it was really like I feel like I'm much more a startup entrepreneur than someone that really believed. I think I never believed that I would come up an institution. I could, like, just see that. You know, I just, because I didn't know how to play that game, because fundamentally as an artist, I knew where I was interested and where I was really strong and what I was really passionate about, and it didn't align. Nobody at that time especially cared about, like, you could not go into an institution and say EDI or inclusion or diversity. Which,
I mean,
is
all
the
these, like, buzzwords that are happening right now, which I also have, like, a lot of feelings about, but...
Nobody cared. They were just didn't, they really didn't care. And I don't think I had the language for it. The language I had was like, this is this great story that I think is theatrical. And I think there's an audience for it, because you're not, I come from this huge community that never goes to the theater. Mm. And that was kind of the move to then start this company and start making work that way. And some of that was taking classics, some of that was doing new work, but always supported and fully funded and supported and, like, really helped the company thrive was the South Asian community, for sure.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.
Mm. So it helped me started directing at a very young age, and just failing a lot, but it would just always be fine because it was just like, oh, hi, auntie. Hello, uncle. You know, and they were like, great, good job. But I was learning. I was getting better, but I was doing it by doing it.
Yeah.
And like in a very stakes way. Then I somehow was really fortunate enough to start working on Monsoon Wedding, which was, again, a big like move into like all of a sudden I was working on a major commercial musical, first as an associate director. Now I'm the book writer. So it just, things just started happening because I just said yes to things.
Mm-hmm.
I would just, because I wanted to do so many different things, and I think I didn't even think I would direct musicals, and now I work on so many new musicals. It's so exciting, but also I'm like, wow. And so it was a lot of things that I think kind of came together a year and a half ago when I started realizing that I wanted some space outside of the company to direct to, and just wanted to see if, oh my God, this is going to sound terrible, but like if everyone else thought I was good at this. Mm-hmm. I think you do reach that. I mean, directing, now I know that I'm doing well for my age, but like I started very young and I've been doing it for a while, and you kind of sometimes are like, is this thing going to happen? You know, and then you kind of need like a fellowship or something to come and be like, no, keep doing it. Like,
yeah,
we think there's something here.
Yeah. I mean, it needs to be in a conversation with
something.
An audience,
yes, yeah.
Anything. It's not created in a vacuum.
Like, yeah. Unless you're just, then you're just journaling, which is fine, which is great. If you please keep journaling, I'm not saying it's not important, but journaling doesn't need validation,
mm-hmm.
but creating a piece of art does. And that always, and you know, it makes it tricky because who are you seeking this validation from? You know,
we won't talk
about that.
whole other conversation. But I think for me at least, I think the word validation, maybe the word is like, I love to use the word conversation.
Mm-hmm,
I love to use the word mm-hmm. conversation because I personally don't need to be validated by an audience, but I want my work to have a conversation, to start a conversation, to engage in a conversation mm-hmm. with whoever who's seeing the work, right?
Mm-hmm. So, I thought we were getting real in this podcast because I definitely seek validation being real, you know, but I think what has changed for me is who I seek validation from.
Mm-hmm.
I've realized that now I have a group of people that I will go to and be like, because my work is rigorous, but the only way I can enact that rigor is if I'm getting feedback about what my work is doing and how it's operating. But now I know who that is.
Right. I mean, as a young artist, it's very hard to do that because it's like you hear all these feedback from all these places,
yeah.
and you're like, you want to incorporate all these things.
Yeah.
But truly, how many of them do you really want to listen to? And how many people do you respect enough to want to listen to their stuff? And really, I think it all has to do with trust.
Mm.
You know, if you mm-hmm. don't, you have to trust this person enough to be like, give me the tea, tell mm-hmm. me everything mm-hmm. that is good, that is bad.
And, yeah.
and sometimes it's hard to get that kind of validation once again, right? Quote unquote validation from people that maybe you don't completely trust and maybe you shouldn't be listening to that. And
yeah. Whose own agendas might are different, or their own critical framework. I mean, that's something we're talking about more now than we have before, which I really appreciate because, you know, everybody has a critical framework.
Yeah, everyone has personal biases. Yeah. Everyone comes from, you know, you bring literally your entire life experience into the room when you're critiquing something that, like, do I want all that baggage?
Yeah.
When I'm looking at the work.
And if you just realize, you know, I mean, we just talked about Golden Threshold, and I said, this is my critical framework, you know? If someone comes to you with that, you know what their point of view is, and then you can listen or not, but it's not about, it's not that my critical framework or that it doesn't exist. I feel like we've been operating in a world where, like, critics or gatekeepers have some kind of understanding of what good work is that is not tied to what their understanding of what good work is.
Oh, 100%.
So I just think like that's something I've kind of evolved to, and not that everybody I want to hear from has the same, of course they don't, but that I've kind of cultivated a community where I know
we'll give you different viewpoints.
They'll give me different viewpoints, but the viewpoints I want
mm-hmm.
and I know will be, and know what I also recognize what I'm trying to do, right? Like, we learn to give feedback that way. What is the project of the piece? Instead of, I think it should be more the story of mom because, you know, 100%. I see mom in, I see myself in mom.
I mean, going down this like critique road, I think that is something that not everybody's equipped with. Mm. But I think it's a learning process because I think a lot of people don't have experience talking about new work. Literally, the point that you just made was so important. What is the intention of the writer? What is the intention of the creator? And whatever you're saying, does it serve the intention or not? And also, as the person receiving the critique, you have to also process that, right? It's like, is this going in line with what I'm trying to accomplish, or it's going against the grain? If like someone tells you this should be about this complete other thing and it has literally nothing to do with what your intention is, maybe you don't want to listen to that.
Yeah, you know? Totally.
But it's also really hard to like toe the line of like, I am just adamant and like so stubborn to listen to any critique and being like, this is what I'm trying to go for and whether I'm successful or not. I always say this, but like writing is easy. Anyone can write, but not everyone can rewrite and not everyone can go through the writing process and literally examine every single word that you put on the page, every single detail that you're trying to go for, and accept the critical eye on the work. That was a lot. I want to say like that was a lot, wasn't it? Like,
yeah, we got like into colonialism and shit. You said deep. I was like, okay.
But if you had to give yourself an advice, right? Like if you think about little Arpita who just moved to the States, you know, 23, that was what we said, 23 years ago, what would you tell her?
That's such a hard question. There's so much, actually. I'm not having trouble whittling it down. I think what I would tell her is that she doesn't need to be like the pretty blonde girl. I think that's what I really wanted. I really wanted to be like, I remember all the popular girls' names. I don't know why I'm even sharing this. I don't even think that many people know how badly I wanted to be a popular girl.
I think that's human. Validation. It goes back to validation, doesn't it?
And as I'm talking about this, I'm like, oh my God, what does this mean about my life right now? Do I just want to be a pop? Like, is this, oh my God. Okay, I'm stressed.
but you literally just said you don't have to be.
Yeah, you don't have to be.
That blonde, popular girl.
Yeah, I like colored my, oh my God, I did so many crazy things. But yeah, I think I was not even like a popular Indian American kid. I remember wanting that really bad. I'm not going to call her out because she's not we're not close anymore. But like, it was just like popular girl and everybody was like wanting to hang out, you know, and with her. And I felt like my life was very wrapped around still academic success, but it was, you know, it was lonely. And then I started kind of becoming friends with this kind of, she's still my best friend, Taz, you know, and this kind of like group that was like kind of rebellious and like, you know, didn't like really care about school, like skipped school all the time. And it's like when I found my kind of family, you know, my first kind of friend group, and it was like great, but I was still kind of young. They were like seniors and they were, you know, graduating. So I started like going to clubs, like drink. I was a bad teen. Rebellious, terrible teenager. Like, I think my dad still looks at me sometimes and he's like, you did something like with your life? Because I would skip school. I was, you know, come home super late, curfew, like just absolute terrible rebel.
Do you think that was like in an attempt to fit in, basically? Yourself mediocre and then doing all these things that what you thought would make you popular.
Yeah, and hurt my parents terribly, you know. I got a job. My dad just wanted me to excel. He would always tell me that he was like, okay, even if you want to be, you know, do the arts, I'm not seeing you like do things towards that, you know. It was more that you're a rebel without a cause and what is it that you're really like running towards or wanting. And I didn't know. I think I was just like wanting to that momentary of like, oh my God, what if I got invited to all the parties, you know, and kind of thing that I was really more, I started driving really, I wanted all the things to be cool. Like that was really what I wanted. And once I became friends with Taz and that crew, it started going away. Mm. And then by the time I went to college, I was just like, oh, that was dumb, you know?
It gets better, guys.
It gets better. It gets better. But like, just know that thing is, that piece of, is. But I think it was I was missing the intimacy I had in India with friends. You know, there was just there's a lot about coming from somewhere and then trying to find your way in a new country that is deeply challenging, emotionally deeply challenging, that, you know, our parents can't understand. That was another thing. Like, I don't think my parents...
Because it's a whole different experience.
It's a whole different thing.
Because they're going through an immigrant experience of their own.
They're going through their own thing, and they can't understand, you know. I remember, oh my God, this memory. Because, you know, it was, my parents were, they were getting their master's still. So they weren't, you know, in jobs yet. And so, you know, they bought us clothes from Walmart. And I remember just coming home one day and just like yelling at my parents that they had humiliated me in school, you know, because of, and now I'm like, I don't care, like, what I put on my body. Like, I care about, but not about brands. And I think it's why specifically even now I'm very, like, not brand conscious at all. But that was, like buying Abercrombie and Fitch clothes, which I don't even think anybody cares about now, was the obsession of my life.
That, once again, I think that's so American, right? The materialism, the wanting to fit
Skechers
in.
Skechers sneakers. Oh, my God. Skechers sneakers. Like, it was so... I think, like, oh, my God, I'm so... But it's, you know, a lot of my friends have kids. And, like, I look at these kids and I'm like, oh, my God, they're going to grow up. And, like, this American school experience, the fact that so many teens are in so much heartache, like... I get it. I felt so isolated and alone, like so much. It was really, really, a really hard time of my life, which could have, in a way, gone many ways for me. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think if it hadn't been for this group of friends, Taz and them, it may have been like really, really dark for me. But they kind of kept, you know, I kind of had a community. And by the time I went to college, like I was fine. But...
That feels very much like New York, too, right?
Yeah.
I think, like, New York,
yeah.
The experience in New York, at least from what I've experienced so far, it can be very isolating at times.
Yeah.
And it's, like, about finding your community. It's about finding the people that you care about that will care about you the same way that you care about them.
Right.
And it's really hard being an artist in terms of, like, oh, how do you draw the line? Like, I want to care about the people that I work with as much as I want to care about their work,
totally.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's the only way to build community, I think, at least.
Yeah.
And I think that literally you sharing that is so applicable to any stage of your life.
Yeah, I think it's true in New York. And I think being an artist is very isolating, and success and, like, you know, failure.
I love that you brought that up, because my next question is literally, how would you define success, quote unquote success, today? Like, if you... What would you tell yourself? Like, what do you tell yourself now that's like, do you think you're successful at this point in your life? Do you think that you want to hit a certain thing in order to be successful? Do you think it's a mindset? What do you think that is?
You know, I think specifically in this last year where, I mean, of course, people have been like, wow, you're really, you know, you're really like making it or whatever.
You are. I don't know why you're brushing that off.
But I'm getting to that. I think it's because, it's very hard to not compare what you're doing with other people.
So hard.
It's super
hard. You turn
hard.
On Instagram and it's like right there.
It's really hard. And driving yourself to more and more and more and more and more is really what I've been doing. And you know, when it was like the fellowship started coming, more jobs started coming, I asked people, because I have no time. I have no time, and I really don't want to come across as I'm complaining, but I was like, oh my God, like, it's just completely burnout, like almost like getting to burnout, but then like then pulling myself back. And so what I realized it had to be, and then always feeling disappointed. right? Mm. Because, like, I had that opportunity. Did I do it well enough? Mm. Because, like, the artistic director didn't call me and say that was getting a production out of a workshop. Like, so many little things are going through your brain after that coffee, you know, like, did I mess up? Did I not talk enough about my aesthetic? You know, so many things are, like, always whirling about the performative aspect of what we have to do, about how much we know and what we say.
And it sometimes gets very icky.
It's very icky.
Yeah.
It can get very icky, you know. And then even at the company, like, feeling like, Hypocrite did so much this year and still feeling like, well, why didn't we get covered by this outlet? Or, you know, so many, you're always dealing with that. And for me, like, this year has really been about, if this is the next many years of my life, it's not going to work out for me. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just not going to be good.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think you...
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
So I think for me, I've redefined success. That success as, you know, and looking at, well, that person's doing that and they're already directing there is, I won't say that I don't do it at all. But whenever I get to it, I start thinking, okay, what do I want to do? Because I have a company. I was really kind of like, you know, evaluating that, do I still need to or want to make work at Hypocrite? And I absolutely do, because I feel some power in that, because there's like, oh, I want to do this project and I don't have to always be pitching as a freelance director.
Do you think the word that goes alongside that concept is like autonomy, mm-hmm. freedom, artistic value that you have control over? I know sometimes it sounds like it does sound a little icky, but no, but I totally hear what you're saying. Make your own fucking reality.
Yeah, yeah. That if we are in the business of imagining things, then we must imagine a world in which we can work without having to do this twice as hard and all of that. And maybe that means that our goals and our way of working and also way of how we appreciate ourselves is different, because the system we say is oppressive is the system that has set up the metric for success. So we can't say, oh my God, the American theater, but like what I want are all the successful metrics that the American theater has set up. Now I just think that if we have to reimagine the whole system, like mm-hmm. that's, and otherwise we're just going to be like sad, because things move forward and things move backwards. Like, you know, it's... right? There was a recent article that the Emmys this year, diversity in nominations has gone way down.
Interesting.
It's gone from like 38 last year to like 24 this year. So, you know, I'm just saying that like we celebrate a year and then the next year the news is like opposite. So just keeping, so maybe it's not the system. Maybe Emmys shouldn't be, or do you know what I mean? Like, it's reimagine the house.
That's such a whole other conversation, because like awards and
yeah.
I mean, we had the conversation about like chasing that
yeah
validation mm-hmm. and what does that mean? What, oh
God, yeah, I so can't many go things. Into that. Yeah, let's move next one.
Last the very I do want to say, like, I find you very inspiring, because I see you work really hard and that inspires me to work really hard. And I mean, for people who don't really have context, we've been talking the whole show and we really, really don't have a lot of context. We're working together.
Yeah.
You're directing our show, The Golden Threshold, that I'm writing with Eric Sorrells.
Yeah.
And I think it has been so invaluable from the moment I approached you in that Musical Theater Factory open share. I'll always remember that, because literally like a few days before or weeks before, I was like, you need to know Arpita. I was like, okay. Let's go let me figure this out. And from the moment we sat down for our first little drink date with Eric.
Keyword being drink. Yeah.
Everything that you have given to us so openly in terms of artistically, creatively, building the story with us, examining the story that we sometimes can be blindsided by because we're not Indian. Mm-hmm. And but we are, I mean, I know people are going to clock me for this, but I'm like, fuck this. But we're all human. We really are all human. And we're really trying to examine an experience that is so specific, that is universal to all cultures, to anyone who struggles with the idea of finding yourself, finding freedom. What does it mean to have a life? What does it mean to live on this planet? What is your worth? And literally everything that you have given to us through so far our multiple rehearsal processes and just talking and being in the room with you, you are such a light. And you drive thought and conversation in certain directions that we would never even think about, you know, in our artistic lives. And I want to say thank you. That's
so sweet. We're going to cry. Because I've now been talking about how I just wanted to be a popular girl.
Don't have to be blonde. You don't. Truly. Because I think what each of us individually contribute to the world is based on our life experiences. Can you imagine if you never wanted to be that popular girl, you would not have experienced the things that you have experienced.
Totally.
In order to gain literally the insight that you have into the work that is being produced right now. So it's
I don't think I would be an empath as much as I am.
Yeah. I mean, if you got everything you wanted, then what's the point, right? Yeah. So before we close this out, I would love to ask if you have a question for me.
What should I ask you? Well, what can you tell me more about when you got interested in writing musicals?
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever asked you all this question. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I think I tell this story sometimes, but I mean, I'm going to tell you this. I mean, to talk about writing musicals, it has to go back to like why I came to the States in the first place.
Yeah.
I came to the States in 2010 for a callback for the Glee project. Do you know Glee?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so they had this like little spin-off reality TV show called The Glee Project.
Oh my God.
That literally Ally Stroker was in. She just won a Tony. She was in the second season. Alex Newell was in the first season. So I was here for a callback. That was my first time traveling alone ever. That's a lie. First time traveling without my parents. Uh-huh. That was my first semester in college back in Singapore. And on that trip, I saw Wicked. I always say it's my first show, but it really isn't. My first show is Mary Poppins. But Wicked was the first pair of Broadway tickets I ever bought. And so I sat in that theater. Mm. I saw Elphaba singing. I was crying while she was singing Defying Gravity. My friend was sleeping right next to me. And I said, this is what I wanted to do. And I never thought wanting to do this. I mean, I was an actor. I mean, I still am an actor, but not actively pursuing that. But writing came a lot later. I think in college, one of my professors, I'm going to shout out to Michael Wartofsky. He teaches musical theater writing, and he graduated from this program at NYU a while ago. And he really inspired this entire, like, my entire college experience was kind of revolved around musical theater. I've never been exposed to musical theater as a child. I grew up knowing nothing about musical theater. I've never seen a show in my life, like a theater show in my life.
You know, kid, sorry, I'm going to, but this is such a common story.
It's
with
crazy.
POC writers or immigrant writers who are like, I had no experience with them, you know? It's so interesting. Anyway, go ahead.
I mean, like, Singapore's theater scene is thriving, but it's growing very rapidly. But as a child growing up, I didn't even get to see Les Mis. Like, I don't know what that was. Like, I had no context of what musical theater was, and I always say that Wicked was a turning point because that whole experience in 2010 December was such a turning point for me that I got a scholarship. I actively sought out a scholarship to go to Berkeley. I actively figured out a way to come to America. I couldn't do the Glee project because I didn't have a visa. I mean, even if I had a visa, I don't know if I would have gotten it. But just like they were like, you don't have a visa. You have to, you know, get one. And I was like, what the fuck is that? And I was,
wait, can't I get this job and then you give me the visa?
That was what I was thinking. I was like, what the fuck? What are you talking about?
And I'm so confused.
No. And so writing came a lot later in college while I was doing musical theater in college. And I was doing a lot of like songwriting plus pop plus orchestration plus theater. And it just like all came together. And after I graduated, 2 years later, I was living in New York and I approached one of my collaborators with this project that has just been like sitting on my computer that was a college project, Eastbound, that you saw.
Right.
And we wrote it. And I, let me just say, it is insane because I've never thought of coming to America ever in my life. It was never in the books.
Yeah.
And I've never thought about writing, be it musical theater, composition, like composition, like wow. Nothing. It came around so like coincidentally. I don't know if that's the word, but it just happened.
Oh my gosh.
And like I realized I could do it well? Me? ?
Yeah. Oh my god. I'm not gonna ask more questions, but were you partly writing to write material for yourself since yes. there's such a scarcity of it? Yeah.
Yes. I mean that was where it started, yeah. For sure.
That's how Lynn became.
That is not wrong.
Did you like that episode of East Side Story? If you did, follow us on Instagram at East Side Story Pod and at Chiang Music. Go on to Apple Podcasts, rate us, review us, and don't forget to subscribe. Or if you're a Spotify user, you can also click the follow button. Even better, you can tell someone about the podcast. And the best part, they don't even have to be Asian. Thank you so much for your support, and I'll see you next week.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.